From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Suppose archaeologists of the future were to dig up women's magazines and use them to judge American women. What would they think of us, and what can we do about it?
25 years ago, the first issue of Ms. Magazine was published. Its 300,000 copies sold immediately. Today, we look at the first quarter century of Ms. and its role in the feminist movement with editor Marcia Gillespie and Ms. co-founder Gloria Steinem. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Justice Department investigators have obtained documents showing that President Clinton was urged to make as many as 40 fundraising calls to wealthy contributors from the White House, nearly three times as many requests for solicitations than was previously known. Although it was unclear how many calls the president actually made, most of those on the list made large donations to the Democrats, and in at least several cases, portions of those donations were improperly transferred to an account that directly benefited President Clinton's reelection campaign, a possible violation of federal election law, this according to officials speaking to the New York Times. The findings contributed to Attorney General Janet Reno's decision last week to open a formal inquiry into whether Clinton illegally solicited donations from the White House. Investigators said today, speaking on the condition of anonymity to the Times, the inquiry, like one recently began for Vice President Al Gore, who has acknowledged making calls from the White House to solicit donations, could be the first step toward the appointment of an independent counsel. Enforcement of child support obligations enters a new era on October 1st, when the federal government will start operating a computerized directory showing every person newly hired by every employer in the country, so federal and state investigators can track down parents who owe money to their children. States will be able to use the directory to locate parents and dun them, typically by securing court orders to employers to deduct child support from wages and salaries. After the votes were counted at a North Carolina food processing plant, workers say managers let the employees know what they really thought of their efforts to form a union. According to Rayshawn Ward, "We were pushed out of the room, beaten up, and spit on." Ward, who was sprayed with mace and handcuffed by security guards, talked about how he stepped in to protect his wife in the melee. If the AFL-CIO has its way, such stories will be seen as more than random incidents of workplace strife. The giant labor federation aims to make the right to organize the next big civil rights issue. The AFL-CIO is gathering in Pittsburgh for its biennial convention, the first celebrating labor's rejuvenation under the presidency of John Sweeney, who's made recruitment his top priority. The Air Force is grounding all of its training flights as part of a safety review. The 24-hour stand-down follows a bad week for the military services. Six of their planes crashed. Four of the planes were from the Air Force or the Air National Guard. The grounding was originally scheduled for this coming Friday, but it was moved up after the most recent crash. That was an Air Force B-1 bomber that went down in Montana Friday, killing all four crew members. President Clinton and Congress struck a deal on a $247.7 billion Pentagon budget, allowing the president to decide whether to buy more B-2 stealth bombers. The pact on Friday provides more spending in the home states of Gingrich and Lott. Meanwhile, President Clinton says he'll veto an education bill if it lacks his national testing proposals. Americans are showing no sign of giving up hamburgers despite contamination scares and warnings about mad cow disease and cholesterol. Across the country, there's been no lag in beef sales reported since the recent recall of 25 million pounds of Hudson Foods ground beef, the largest meat call in the nation's history. The former manager of a fast food restaurant in Nebraska says business didn't even slow down. In other health news, former Fen-Phen users want makers of the diet drugs to pay for their heart monitoring. Class action suits demanding just that have been filed in New York, Utah, Colorado, Hawaii, and California. Attorney Gary Mason, whose law firm is coordinating the lawsuits, says within a few weeks, suits will be filed in all 50 states. Fenfluramine, one half of Fen-Phen, has been pulled off the market along with another diet drug, dexfenfluramine, after studies link those pills to serious heart damage. President Clinton will talk about the role of the United Nations in an increasingly complex world when he addresses the UN General Assembly this morning. He'll also touch on U.S. plans to pay off its UN debt, which is the issue members are probably most interested in hearing about. Meanwhile, in Washington, current and former IRS employees are expected to testify to a Senate committee today that the agency encourages the use of threats and intimidation. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says taxpayers deserve to be treated with common decency. He says Tuesday's hearings will reveal a lot about the attitude of the Internal Revenue Service. And this news from Germany, a far-right party with staunchly anti-foreigner views scored stunning gains in yesterday's ballot in Hamburg, and the Social Democratic mayor said he'd step down after his party's significant losses. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. The Water Lilies, with an updated version of Helen Reddy's classic, I Am Woman. The Water Lilies on a CD called Just Say Row. And this begins our hour discussion today about Ms. Magazine on this 25th anniversary, the first national circulation magazine to come out of the women's movement. When it first came out 25 years ago, Ms. was immediately derided by the media pundits of the day. Newscaster Harry Reasoner declared he would give it 6 months before it ran out of things to say. Nonetheless, the 300,000 copies that were supposed to last for months flew off the newsstands in only 10 days. In its premier 1972 issue, prominent American women first publicly announced they had had abortions, while such operations were still illegal in most of the United States. That same year, it was the first magazine to advocate for the Equal Rights Amendment and to rate presidential candidates on women's issues. In 1976, Ms. offered the first cover story on domestic violence, and a year later, it was the first magazine to do a cover story on sexual harassment. Subsequently, Ms. became one of the few advertising-free, 100% reader-supported mass circulation magazines. And here to talk about its history as well as its future are two people, Marcia Ann Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Ms. Magazine since 1993. Before that, she was the editor of Essence Magazine from 1971 to 1980. And Gloria Steinem, one of the founding editors of Ms. Magazine, perhaps one of the best-known feminist activists in the United States. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
And yes, thank you. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Well, why don't we start off with how you all started off. Gloria, you were there. What happened in 1972? What led to the founding of Ms. Magazine?
Well, it began the previous year when some of us had been out speaking on the road for, you know, the newly reborn feminist movement, and it was very clear that there needed to be many more sources of information, and that the idea that the feminist movement was only 12 crazy people on the East and West Coast, respectively, was just not true. So we began to talk together as writers and editors to figure out whether we could or really wanted to start a women's magazine. We decided that we did, but we were unable to raise money to maintain a woman-controlled magazine. But luckily, since some of us had been working for New York Magazine, New York offered to pay for a sample issue. And that was the one that you described earlier that went flying off the newsstand. So we knew that readers really did want it.
And what were the major issues of the day in 1972 that weren't being addressed seriously by the rest of the media?
Well, the rest of the media really wasn't saying that women were equal, or if they were, they were presenting it as a contentious point of view next to which they had to publish an article saying they weren't equal in order to be objective. So the idea that women's role was political, that it could change, that it was not due to biology or to God or to Freud or something immutable, was not an idea that was out there in the media. And clearly there was this whole movement burgeoning that was challenging all the different parts of women's role. So Ms. was meant to be a forum for many different views, but which started out with the bottom line that women were full human beings.
Who were the women who started Ms.?
There were, you know, all the writers at New York Magazine. There was Joanne Edgar, who had recently come from being a civil rights worker in Mississippi. There was Mary Tom, who was working for Facts on File. There was Mary Peacock, who had just edited a wonderful anti-fashion fashion magazine called Rags. So she was always our fashion person. We called her Mr. Mary. soon there was Suzanne Levine, who came on as managing editor. She really was, people thought I was the only editor, but really it was all of us in a group, and if there was a single editor, it was Suzanne. And then, of course, Pat Carbine, who had been working away to start the magazine and was the first publisher.
And she was an editor at, what, McCall's?
At McCall's, yes.
Mm-hmm. And weren't there a number of sexual discrimination lawsuits that were just coming to a head at that time? Ev Magazine's, that women were suing for discrimination?
Well, there was a suit against Newsweek. There was one burgeoning against the New York Times. I think there was one against Merrill Lynch. There was the Ma Bell suit. There were a number of class action suits and various kinds of sex discrimination suits that were just beginning.
Gloria Steinem, one of the founders of Ms. Magazine. Marcia Gillespie, what were you doing in 1972, and how did Ms. affect you? This is long before you became editor.
I was the editor-in-chief of Essence Magazine at the time, and I think, like so many women across this country, heard that this magazine was about to debut, and I remember making sure that I hit the newsstands, you know, to get my copy before anybody else, you know what I mean, beat me to it, bringing it into the office, you know what I mean, and sitting in my office with the other editors of Essence, going through, you know, page after page of this magazine.
Looking for the mistakes as a competitor?
No, it was really, saying, whoa, so what are they really going to say here? Do you know what I mean? How does this feminism play out on the page? It was with great excitement.
How is it different from, for example, Essence? I mean, here you were a woman who was running Essence. Essence was predominantly for an African-American audience, but many of the people there are women who read your magazine. What was the different slant?
Well, you know, I'd like to say, in part, we shared a similar passion. We worked it out, I want to call it, in different ways. But what immediately, made me sit up and take notice was that, you look at a woman's magazine and women's magazines, I want to say as the sun rises, there were these things that we were supposed to do. You had to have food. You had to have makeup. You had to have, and there was Ms. And it's called Excuse Me. do you know what I mean? There is a life outside of the kitchen and the bathroom and the, do you know what I mean? And one's closet. So that there was a whole magazine addressing women, do you know what I mean? Truly from the inside out, not from the outside in, if you get what I mean.
Mm-hmm. What led you to move from Essence and then a few years break to become the editor of Ms. Magazine?
Well, it was more than a few years break, but once I decided to leave Essence and knew that I still wanted to maintain some contact with the magazine in the world, I loved it that, Pat Carbine and Suzanne Braun Levine approached me in 1980 and said, would you become a contributing editor to Ms.? Ms. was the only other magazine that I really felt passionately about. So it was like, do you know what I mean? I left one family and I came to another family, but it felt like the same family, if that makes any sense.
What were you doing after you left Essence?
I was doing freelance writing. I was consulting. I lived in Jamaica for, you know, off and on, and during the early 80s. I was, you know, doing the freelance thing.
And then you became editor of the magazine that you had run to get from the newsstands about 8 years before.
Well, I, you know, had been a contributing editor, and then I was a columnist for Ms., and then I became the, I was doing a little freelance thing, and the next thing I know, I was hired as the executive editor in the late 80s. And then, I left, I came back, and then here I am, you know what I mean, as the editor-in-chief. So it's been like this wonderful kind of serendipitous journey, you know?
Well, before we go to the 25th anniversary issue, which takes on many different issues, I wanted to go back to the first issue of Ms. Magazine on December 20th, actually, 1971, right before 1972. Gloria Steinem, do you remember the picture on the cover?
Yes. You can see that I had lived in India, because this is a blue woman like Krishna with many arms. We were looking for a cover image that would be inclusive, and so you know, we wanted to be racially inclusive and inclusive of many different occupations, and so we ended up with a blue woman.
So you thought blue covered it all.
Blue, right. Blue was good, we thought. And in her many arms, she is holding the various symbols of women's traditional roles, and in her tummy there is a baby.
In the arms, you have an iron, a typewriter, a steering wheel, a telephone.
Yes, a fried egg. And there's a tear running down her cheek because she is expected to do everything.
And on the top, it says, Gloria Steinem, on finding out who we are. What did you write about in that first issue?
I wrote an article about sisterhood because I think my and many women's revelations that came from just talking about our own lives was the sharing of our situation. We had been made, and sometimes still are made, to feel crazy and alone, but out of consciousness-raising groups, rap groups, whatever you want to call them, out of just simple truth-telling, we were beginning to have the experience of saying what was happening to us and hearing 6 or 10 other women say, you feel like that? I thought only I felt like that. And from that shared experience came a feeling of connection to other women, which was a new feeling, because remember that we had then, it still happens, but we then were really supposed to compete with each other. The mythology that women could not possibly get along, that we competed for the favors of men, that we were intrinsically jealous, was very, very powerful. I remember this came just after I had met with Marlo Thomas about writing a film script for her. And we were in a room together, and we later discovered that men were kind of wandering up and down the hall saying, you know, assuming that we must be fighting and screaming at each other. Meanwhile, we were having a great time. So this discovery, not of the sameness of women, that isn't what sisterhood means, but the shared experience of being female in a patriarchal society, that once you begin to fight, it allows you to be unique individuals. That's what sisterhood meant.
After our break, I want to also ask you about something, a phenomenon that is growing today, and that is the Promise Keepers. In just 2 weeks, they're going to be having a national march on Washington. It's expected to rival, maybe not be quite as big as the Million Man March, but it raises some very interesting issues. I also want to ask you both about your histories, and for people who don't know, Gloria, one of your first columns that you got most well-known for was a piece you wrote about trying out as a Playboy bunny. Did that come before Ms. Magazine?
Yes, that came before Ms.
I assume that your trying out came before that.
No.
Was that how you tried to support
Ms.?
I
couldn't have supported Ms. that way, because the Playboy bunnies were terrifically underpaid, as it turned out. But that had been a decade before, when I was working for Show Magazine. In a way, that was one of my first understandings of feminism, inadvertently, because I was sent to do an expose of what it was like to work as a bunny. And I discovered, of course, that though I was supposed to ridicule the women in the eyes of my editors, I actually had more in common with the women than I did with my editors.
Well, I'm going to ask you after the break just what exactly you did find out and how that led you to write the kinds of pieces you did and then co-found Ms. Magazine. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we're talking to two women, Gloria Steinem, co-founder of Ms. Magazine, which first came on the stands just at the end of 71. It's now considered the 25th anniversary. And we're talking to Marcia Ann Gillespie. She's the current editor of Ms. Magazine, formerly the editor of Essence Magazine. Stay with us.
For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. We are a grandmother's prayers. We are a grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of the ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We are mothers of courage, fathers of time, daughters of dust, sons of great visions. We're sisters of mercy, brothers of love, lovers of life, and builders of nations. We're seekers of truth.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests, Marcia Ann Gillespie and Gloria Steinem. Marcia Ann Gillespie, the editor-in-chief of Ms. Magazine since 1993. She was the editor of Essence Magazine from 1971 to 1980, during which she transformed the publication to one of the fastest-growing women's magazines in the United States. Gloria Steinem is one of the founding editors of Ms. Magazine. She presently serves on the board of directors of the National Women's Political Caucus, the Coalition of Labor Union Women, and the Ms. Foundation for Women. Her most recent books include Revolution from Within, a book about self-esteem, and Moving Beyond Words. Gloria, you were just talking about your experience as a Playboy bunny, or you didn't really try out for one, but you were doing it for Show Magazine. What did you find the women were going through? Do you think it's very much different from what they go through today?
Well, I'm happy to say that there are no more Playboy clubs, at least in this country. They're now still alive in other countries. But the whole idea was that you were kind of hung on a meat hook as an object. I mean, you were wearing a costume that was so tight that it would give a man a cleavage, and high heels that were 3 inches tall and so on. But at the same time, you were really a waitress, and it was extremely hard work, as all waitresses know.
How long did you do it for?
I did it off and on for a month, and it was supposed to be a very glamorous and well-paying job. What I found out, of course, was that people were very poorly paid, that in the month that I was there, almost the whole group of women had quit, or the personnel had changed, the working conditions were in no way tolerable by any standards. I spent part of my time there trying to persuade women to unionize, and they said that actually this had been tried in Florida, and they had been met with physical threats. So, what was presented as a glamorous, frippery, self-indulgent, sure all women would want to do this thing, was actually an extremely unpleasant, overworked, exploitative kind of situation where most women, I got a glimpse of what was coming when, during the interview, I had made up a background for myself as having been a secretary but wanting to do something more interesting. And the woman who was interviewing me said, honey, if you can type, what would you want to work here for?
Gloria Steinem, what about the direction Ms. has gone in since 1972? It seems to be, to me, particularly in the last few years, it's gotten a much broader international focus with a great emphasis on that. Marcia Gillespie, maybe you can talk about that.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. It has broadened its focus. It does carry much more, you know, coverage of what's happening to women outside of the United States. And much of the credit for that really belongs to Robin Morgan, who was my immediate predecessor as the editor-in-chief of the magazine. Many people will know that, you know, Robin was instrumental in, you know, setting up the Sisterhood is Global Foundation, and they've, you know, done books that really do, you know, address women's experiences and sensibilities and condition, you know, outside of this country.
I was just thinking about that as Gloria was saying, Playboy is gone here, and the Playboy clubs, not the magazine, but there it is around the world.
Absolutely, even though I have to almost remind us that while Playboy is gone, you know, we then have something like Hooters, which is, you know, now, you know, the big national chain, which is in many ways a crasser version, you know what I mean, of that same old ugly story about women, you know, objectified and diminished and demeaned.
One of the things that we don't think of about advertising pressures is that it keeps us from getting international news in our magazines because they won't pay for international consumers, if you see what I mean. So the fact that Ms. has more international coverage is now in part due to the fact that we no longer are dependent in any economic sense on advertising.
Now, that's a big deal. When did you change from advertisers to not?
In 1990.
I remember a controversy over tobacco advertisers and the way that they were playing to women. I remember a controversy at Ms. whether mm-hmm. there should be any accepting of advertising.
Yes, ironically, though, tobacco advertisers exerted less influence on the surrounding editorial copy than the other advertisers of traditional women's products,
like that,
clothing, food, makeup,
drugs,
cleaning products, and so on, fragrance. You know, they all insisted on a cheerful atmosphere and one that praised their products. The tobacco ads might object to expose reporting about lung cancer, but they didn't insist that you praised smoking, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So when we first started, we had a big debate, would we take cigarette advertising? And at that time, we decided that we would, provided they put a warning on the ad saying it was harmful to your health, on the notion that if readers had the information, you know, they could
Oh, they didn't have
make
to do that
own.
Back then? They
no.
didn't have to?
Mm-mm, they, huh. Right, they were just beginning to do that.
Hmm. Marcia Ann Gillespie, what about this issue of Ms. Magazine, the one that says 25 years over the cover in a brilliant pink? I think this gives listeners a good idea of the direction that that Ms. Magazine has gone in, to take a look at the various, well, you have the 1972 classics like the article from the first issue, The Housewife's Moment of Truth by Jane O'Reilly in spring of 1972, and you go right through to today.
Well, what we really wanted to do with this issue was to both, you know, look back and remember where we've been, as well as address where are we now and where are we going. Because, you know, it's interesting with this idea of silver anniversaries, one can end up, you know, like, I want to say, you know, like wallowing in the past and not, you know, really looking at the fact that, you know, Ms. is a living entity. It's an ongoing thing. It's not just about what happened in 1972. It's about, you know, how this magazine continues to reach out and serve, you know what I mean, a readership by talking about, you know, the issues that affect women's lives, you know, now, and what we think are going to be the challenges that we'll be facing in the future.
You talk about, you single out young women under 30, talk about the leaders of tomorrow. Who were some of the women you chose, and what were the criterion you use for these heroines?
Well, you know, I must tell you that the hardest job I think that we ever had was narrowing this list to, you know, just to this number of women, you know, because we could have had 100, we could have had 200, the number was endless. And what we were looking for were people who were, you know, like doing a feminist work and taking the principles of feminism and helping to push the frontiers, either, you know, as journalists, because we have a number of people who are journalists there. We have activists who are doing, you know, real, you know what I mean, on the ground social change work. We have people who are in politics. We have people who are, you know, in business for themselves. And what we wanted to, you know, remind ourselves, do you know what I mean, as well as to celebrate, is the fact that there's a whole new generation coming. You know, everybody has this idea, you know, that, you know, feminists all, you know, were feminists in 1972 and there was no one who came after us. And in fact, what we're seeing is wave after wave of younger women who are, do you know what I mean, taking, you know, the principles of this movement and moving forward.
Name some of the women and what they have done that you chose.
Oh, well, it's like I just opened a page and I'm putting on my glasses. It's called, you know, been doing 50 now for a while. We include Renku Sen, who is here in the United States. She's a 30-year-old. She has been so active in third world organizing. She's California-based. We have Farai Chidey, whom many people know, who's a journalist who has appeared, you know what I mean, both on radio and in television.
Formerly with CNN, and
that's
now
right.
She's on ABC.
That's right. We have Julie Su, who has worked, you know, again, based in California, you know, and she's at the Asian Pacific American Legal Center. And she has really done a lot of work on behalf of immigrants and the ways in which immigrant groups are so often unjustly and unfairly, you know, discriminated against, as well as terribly exploited in the workplace. We have people like Kara Walker, who's an amazing, a young African-American artist whose work, you know, which is very feminist and very, you know, female-centered, really begins to relook at history and take history and recast it by making Black women the center of things as opposed to on the periphery of life, which is the way in which we are often discussed.
When you say feminist, what do you mean, Marsha Gillespie?
Well, you know, I mean lots of things, but I always start out with the very simplest, you know, which is the one which is called, let's look in the dictionary. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, you know, social, political, and economic equality. Let's, you know, let's look at the ways in which women's equality matters. How do we make it matter? How do we make it real in the lives, not just of women and men in society, and not just in this country? So, you know, when I think about being a feminist, what I think I'm of is I'm a person who believes in human potential. And I believe that, you know, we all have a right and an obligation to nurture human potential to its very highest. And that's what feminism is about.
Would you like to add anything to that, Gloria Steinem?
No, I'll go along with the dictionary. I think that's pretty good. I think the problem that we have with the word falls into two categories. One is that people don't know what it means, and when they do go to the dictionary and see what it means, then they say, okay, I am a feminist. You know, men and women say that. But the second problem is they do know what it means. I mean, you know, it does constitute a huge, it's not called the longest revolution for nothing. So it is a revolution, not a public relations movement, and it is going to get opposition. Of course, the question is also compared to what? I notice in the public opinion polls that feminists are more approved of than lawyers.
Moving up in the world. You talk about that in your column in this latest Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem, revving up for the next 25 years, where you talk about feminism not being called the longest revolution for nothing. And you talk about the modern day feminist movement's origins back in the 1970s. Can you talk about that?
Well, there were these great moments, as I try to describe, of the light bulb going off over our heads as we began to realize that women's position was political, not natural. A realization that often comes as a team realization with the understanding that race is not a natural dividing of human beings, but rather is used politically, and indeed had sprung out of the newly reinvigorated civil rights movement, and the movement against Vietnam, too, because in challenging the idea that violence is an acceptable way of solving conflict, you're challenging part of the masculine role, and many men were very courageously challenging that, too, and women were disproportionately supportive of the peace movement. So all of these things were happening in the late 60s, early 70s, and came together, coalesced as the feminist movement, because it became more and more clear that we could challenge these bases of society, and also that they were not fully being challenged even within these very admirable movements. So it was partly that women in the civil rights and peace movements were finding themselves, you know, churning out mimeograph machines and serving coffee and so on, and realizing there needed to be an autonomous emphasis on the sexual caste system, too.
I like what you said about also sort of rising up against the male-led intellectual left, which sometimes practice what Robin Morgan humorously called ejaculatory politics, revolution tomorrow or I'm going home to my father's business.
Yes, I love that phrase of Robin's and also of another friend, Lee Grant, who's an actress I think is now resigned after 25 years to me constantly quoting her because she said, well, I've been married to one Marxist and one fascist and neither one took the garbage out. So we began to realize that there was a patriarchal structure that was deeper than most of the existing political labels.
We're talking to Gloria Steinem and Marcia Ann Gillespie, the co-founder of Ms. Magazine and the current editor-in-chief of Ms. Magazine. Now the issue of race and the women's movement and how the feminist movement, the modern incarnation of it, has dealt with it. Maybe we've saw it play out very well in the last few months with that statue in Congress, the statue that commemorated the women who fought for suffrage and had Elizabeth K. Stanton, Katie Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony, but left out Sojourner Truth. It's a statue that was done many years ago, had been in the crypt of Congress in the basement for, something like 70 years. But when it was going to be put where it has been put now, in a place of honor, some women's groups, and that's African-American women's groups, rose up and said, without Sojourner Truth, we should not have this statue. What are your feelings about that, Marcia?
I mean, I would have loved to have seen Sojourner Truth included in the statue. Absolutely. I mean, I would have loved it. I didn't have, you know what I mean? It wasn't my decision. I couldn't, make it happen. Does that mean that I think that the statue should have been left, you know what I mean, in the basement? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, it is still an important testimony to, you know, three of the women who, you know, made a major impact on this society. But I think we're getting at something much more than a statue. And that becomes, you know, the way in which, you know, many African-American women have felt, I want to call it, displaced by or left out of the women's movement. And, you know, what, you know, we have to constantly remind ourselves, which is why I guess the Sojourner Truth, you know, issue rose up. So, and that is, you know, we have what I call perception versus reality in this country about who was there. You know what I mean? Who was there? So that you have, whether we're dealing with the, you know, the original movement of the 19th century or the second wave of the movement, this persistent belief that, you know, there were only white women in the room. And there were always more than white women in the room. You know, whether we're looking in the 19th century at black women's participation, which was there, or we're looking, you know, through the suffragist movement, whether we're looking at this current movement. What happened was that, you know, we were often ignored both by the mainstream outside and sometimes by our sisters inside the movement. You know, it's called not unusual given, you know, I mean, the way America works. But, you know, I mean, the fact is, you know, this has been a movement that has been diverse. Do you know what I mean? And that varying groups of women have taken it and reapplied it for their experiences. So that, you know, in today's world, we will find African-American women who maybe don't use the big F word, but will use the big W word of womanist. You know, in which they are, you know, redefining it within the context of our experience. You know, I mean, I would hope everybody could get comfortable, you know, under this umbrella with the big F word. Doesn't matter, as long as we begin to use the principles and apply it to make real change. Now, patriarchy is so, you know what I mean, the system is, it's an incredible thing the way it works, because part of the way in which, again, you continue to separate women is when you say to women, you know, okay, you're chocolate brown, you can't be with the vanilla people because their issues aren't the same as your issues. Well, you know, the thing I've always said to my sisters, meaning my African-American sisters, is that, you know, we have to be in the room, because the truth is, if racism were to be, you know, completely eradicated tomorrow, we would still be addressing issues of gender. So we have to do the work, both of those activities, as do white feminists, have to be as engaged in work for racial justice as they are for gender justice, because that's what feminism speaks to. It speaks to equality. Simple, equality.
And And I would say, just from a very practical point of view, that what we it's ironic that we repeated the errors of the suffragist movement with that statue, because that should be a lesson, you know, right there. But in fact, race and sex are intertwined caste systems. And if I can say it as simply as possible, if you're going to maintain a racial caste system, you have to maintain a certain amount of racial, quote, purity, unquote, racial difference. And that requires restricting women as the means of reproduction. It means restricting the bodies of women. White women are restricted in order to keep the superior race, quote, pure, unquote. Women of color are supposed to reproduce cheap labor and be cheap labor themselves. It differentially affects women, but it is race and sex caste. Actually, you can't practically defeat one without attacking the other. It simply doesn't work.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Marcia Ann Gillespie for joining us. She has to head off to work, and Gloria Steinem is going to stay with us for the next segment. Marcia Ann Gillespie, editor-in-chief of the current Ms. Magazine, celebrating 25 years of publication. Again, Marcia Ann Gillespie formerly was the editor-in-chief of Essence Magazine, and Gloria Steinem is also with us, co-founder of Ms. Magazine and so much more. Thanks for being with us, Marcia.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, heard from Hawaii to Maine, from Washington to Florida, California to New York, and many cities in between. I'm Amy Goodman. We're also advertisement-free, as is Ms., celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And Gloria Steinem remains with us. Gloria Steinem, one of the founding editors of Ms. Magazine, part of a collective in 1971 that put this publication together. I don't know if you thought it would continue for 25 years. I think it was very interesting what Harry Reasoner had to say. 6 months, and then you won't have anything else to say. Gloria, you're still talking.
No, I was clear that Harry Reasoner was wrong, that there was infinitely more to say, but I did think for my own work life, you know, that this is something I will do just for a couple of years and then I'll go back to my real life, which of course now I realize this is my real life. But there was so much discouragement at the beginning that it is truly amazing and gratifying to see that it's lasted 25 years.
Let's talk about some of your work since then and during these years. First off, I wanted to ask you a little about Anita Hill. I was just looking at the paper yesterday, and I saw that she's coming out with a book in the next few weeks, actually, about her life. Do you think things have changed? And you personally, I mean, her whole case, of course, was about sexual harassment. And she lamented the fact that she felt things had not changed from many years ago until the time when she testified, when the same stuff was hurled at her, you know, that she was a disgruntled employee, that she probably wasn't telling the truth, or actually was perhaps she had felt spurned herself, and so she was going to get the guy who spurned her, who now happens to be on the Supreme Court. Do you feel things have changed, particularly in that way, Ms. Magazine, which had the first cover on sexual harassment?
Yes, I do. And I think the kind of three-day painful teach-in that the national coverage of those Senate hearings brought us really was key. After all, the term and the understanding of sexual harassment had been around for a very long time. Karen Sauvigner and others at Cornell had coined this term to describe what was happening to women in the workforce, what they were reporting, you know, when they came into their institute at Cornell. Later on, Catherine MacKinnon became the legal theorist that framed this as sexual harassment. We had done an early cover story and many other cover stories, but it still hadn't entered the national consciousness in the same way that it did after those painful days of hearings. After that, the number of complaints rose dramatically. The number of companies seeking some kind of sensitivity training or help in making sure that they didn't face these kind of lawsuits, that increased. So, you know, it has changed a great deal. Of course, there's a backlash, too, because there's this notion that, you know, saying anything constitutes sexual harassment, when in fact it's usually extremely clear and easy to define.
At the time, people said if there was a woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee, this would not have happened, which brings me to the National Women's Political Caucus and its founding, which was right around the time of Ms. Magazine, and you were a part of that. Can you talk about that, the idea that if women came into power, that they would raise these kinds of issues? How did NWPC, the National Women's Political Caucus, get started?
Well, when Ms. began and when the caucus began, you must remember that the main way, almost the only way, that women got into high political office was as widows. You married a man who had a Senate seat or a congressional seat, and he died through no fault of yours, of course, and only then...
or at least as far as we know.
Jeanette Rankin was just about the only exception to that rule. So it was very blatant that there was an absence of women of all races from the political scene, and that we would not truly have a democracy until our ruling bodies looked like the country. Now, the National Organization for Women at that point did not have an electoral emphasis. And so the National Women's Political Caucus started in order to focus on the need for elected and appointed women, not just any women, but women who supported other women. There perhaps would have been less confusion if we'd called it the National Feminist Political Caucus.
Well, aren't there certain beliefs that a woman has to hold in order to be supported by the National Women's Political Caucus, for example, to be pro-choice?
Yes, to be pro-choice, to support reproductive freedom, which means the freedom to have children as well as not to have children. So it means being against coerced sterilization and so on. Just because the right wing focuses on abortion, we sometimes forget that there's another side to this freedom, to support the Equal Rights Amendment. There was a whole statement of principles. Of course, it varies as it plays out in different local races, but it's clear that this is meant to be for women who support other women.
Mm-hmm. It's all about choice, and one of the choices you made in your life was not to have children. And yet, you are known as a mentor for many young women, young feminists. How do you feel about that choice today as you're in your 60s now?
Well, I've never regretted it. I, of course, I didn't make it for a long time because the pressure to have children was so great that I sort of couldn't afford to think to myself, I'm not going to have children. It made you a crazy person. So I kept saying, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm definitely doing that, but not right now. And then, thanks to the women's movement, I discovered, of course, that we don't all have to make the same choice, and that I was happy not being a biological parent. And I'm very happy having a lot of young women and a few young men in my life, too. I feel so grateful to their parents for having them. I'm constantly calling them up and saying, thank you, because I get such pleasure. When you were talking about the women in this issue, 21 young leaders for the 21st century, they're women in their 20s and their early 30s. I would also like to say that there are young leaders from 9 to 16, and I'm sure even younger, but I've been spending a lot of time working with girls lately. It's wonderful to see the clarity that exists at 9, 10, and 11 about, you know, who they are and what they want to do. And I always worry about the descent of the feminine role upon them at 11 or 12, which tends to turn us into female impersonators, but the strength is all there. It's absolutely there.
I mean, there's this new book out, Reviving Ophelia, that deals with that age and what happens to girls. And I think psychologist Carol Gilligan has talked a lot about that time where you have girls with such confidence until the age of 9, and then suddenly they seem to lose it all. Mm-hmm. And that's when, in competition with boys, they fall off.
Yes, yes. It's a very crucial point. The point for boys comes earlier, apparently, say about 5 to 8, when the role of a little boy comes down upon them, when they are suddenly told that they're not supposed to cry and they're not supposed to show emotion. They're not supposed to be as close to their mothers. And sometimes mothers have been made to feel, too, that in order to make boys into masculine creatures, they have to reject them in some way. And they push them away, which means sometimes as men they have a harder time trusting women because they've been betrayed, they feel, you know, by this woman who was closest to them. So these roles are punishing for men and boys too. They're more punishing for women, so we're out on the forefront of this revolution, but it is something that has an impact on absolutely every, you know, living human being in this country.
As you talk about boys and girls and psychological development, I am thinking about your book, Moving Beyond Words, and your question, what if Freud were Phyllis?
I had a great time asking that question. It flowed from a question that I had previously asked in the pages of Ms. Magazine, which is, what if men could menstruate? Obviously, it would become a great thing. People would brag about it, you know, on and on. So I decided to
personal days would be you would get for each month.
Right, right. There would be a National Institute of Dysmenorrhea, and it would be used as a rationale, I thought, for why, math capability. You know, if you have this inbuilt measure of time, of course, it's laughter is important, I think, as a way of seeking or understanding crazy contradictions, you know. So I thought I would simply make Freud a woman, which I had originally done while addressing the American Psychiatric Association as a plea for empathy, you know, trying to get the overwhelmingly male occupation of psychiatry to understand how they would feel if most of the professionals were women and instructed by Phyllis Freud in the superiority of women, of people with wombs, the inevitability of womb envy and so on in these male inferior creatures who were most of the patients.
You know, yesterday I had a funny experience. I called a local bookstore and I asked whether they had your books. And they said, yes, they had a number of copies of Revolution from Within. And they had also the audio version of Moving Beyond Words, your book, where you talk about what if Freud were Phyllis. And they also said, well, then there's the man on the other end of the phone said, and then there's Men Are Pigs and Deserve to Die. And I said, oh, and you have that? And so he said, no, they're all out. I said, oh, it must be very popular. He said, I'm afraid so. But what is that?
I've never heard of it.
Oh, they say, well, maybe he was joking, but he said, and then there's Men Are Pigs and Deserve to Die.
Well, I'm sorry he feels that that's an add-on to my name, but that must be something we have yet to look forward to. I bet it's written by a man.
That's something like Stein or Steinem, because it was right there. In your a couple of columns ago, maybe it was in the issue before the 25th anniversary issue of Ms., you took on Larry Flint and the whole phenomenon of his movie. I thought it was a very interesting analysis.
Well, what troubled me deeply, and obviously a lot of other people, about that movie was not the movie itself, but its pretense of being about a real person. If it had been The People versus Larry Smith, it would have been different. But it represented as the fact a man. It showed Larry Flint as being somebody who was really pro-sex, who was loved women, and so on, and was simply a victim of the First Amendment, or a champion, I should say, of the First Amendment.
Is seen as the great hero of the First Amendment.
But in fact, if anybody who knows the many years of Hustler's work or the many other magazines he publishes knows that it is about evisceration and torture and pain. And in fact, if the images that are in Larry Flint's work had been images of any group of men, Jewish men, Italian men, black men. Actually, there is a huge amount of racism in his work, too. I'd like to, you know, mention that in a minute. But if those eviscerated, tortured images have been had been even of animals, the film would never have been made. And that question was asked of what was his
Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson, who played Larry Flint, by the Today Show. And Woody Harrelson, when asked, you know, would he have played this if the images had been of animals, said absolutely not.
Being tortured.
So I think, you know, I think that says everything about it. Now, the second interesting result was, even though I said at the end of the, I made very clear that I was using my First Amendment rights to protest this movie, the idea was that I was somehow against the First Amendment. And I think that it's very revealing that we can criticize the president, we can criticize government agencies, corporations, many centers of power in this country, and not be perceived as being against the First Amendment. But uniquely, when we criticize pornography, we're seen that way. I even have T-shirts now that say I'm against pornography and support the First Amendment, you know, in an effort to clarify this. Because the pornography industry, which is twice as big as Hollywood, has put so much money and effort into making it seem that to criticize them at all is somehow against free speech.
Well, I guess that came together with Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin's efforts in the country to start to limit what they perceived as evidence of sexual torture and abuse and pass local legislation that would limit that. I think that's
where
the free speech
but
issue
even
came
that,
in.
That's that is the closest. But first of all, the argument that we were against the First Amendment was there beforehand. Secondly, the ordinance that they proposed was not one which supported censorship. It was not one that asked for prior restraint. It never said something couldn't be published. It only said that if it had already been published and if it could be shown to the satisfaction of a jury that it had contributed to a crime, then there could be civil damages posed. That's mm-hmm. a very long way from censorship.
I thought it's interesting your point of where the word pornography comes from.
Yes, perhaps as a writer, I especially, well, I think it's useful because it helps us parse out what the differences are, that pornography comes from porne, which means female slavery, and thus it means the depiction of female slavery in words or in pictures, whereas erotica comes from eros, which means love, which has a clear connotation of pleasure and free choice, not of pain and degradation.
You said Larry Flint was also racist.
Larry Flint and Hustler, if you look at what's been printed over the years, there are the most horrific depictions of black men. Black men are almost never depicted without, you know, tiny heads and huge penises and so on. Black women are shown having sex with animals. But there is racism that we would never tolerate in any other setting, and yet because it's called sex, which of course it isn't, but because it's called sex, suddenly it's supposed to be off limits. We really need to apply to what's called sex the same standards of humanity that we would apply to any other area.
Well, Gloria Steinem, on that note, clearly the struggle goes on, and I want to thank you very much for joining us, along with Marshawn Gillespie, who is here for the first two segments, talking about the feminist movement and Ms. Magazine's last quarter of a century on this 25th birthday of Ms. Magazine.
And I want to thank you for giving us this wonderful time of news and information and understanding and smarts and, I'm really very grateful. Given the rest of the state of the media, we're all grateful.
Well, thank you. If you'd like a copy of this show, you can call the Pacific Archives and order a cassette copy at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to make a comment on the show, we can play some of those comments. You can call 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered the show from New York. Actually, Dred Scott Keyes did that today. Andy York was our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.